Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, aside from my voice not being very pleasant to listen to, we have progressive candidate Lauren Ashcraft. She'll join us to discuss her primary challenge against longtime incumbent Carolyn Maloney in New York's 12th Congressional District. We're also going to replay an interview I did with Mondaire Jones in August of 2019. Mondaire is running in New York's 17th. It's an open seat. Nita Lowey, who had been in that seat for ages, has retired. He is the true progressive, maybe the only progressive, who's really running in that district. You want to listen and you want to support both these candidates. Also, of course, we'll also have Heather Digby Parton from Hullabaloo to break down this week's news. And if you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the show. You can help us out by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. Now, time to break down this week's news. Heather Digby Parton from Hullabaloo and Salon. So, Heather, first off, let me just say to folks, I apologize for my voice again. A little bit rough these days, but hopefully improving. This week has been, you know, there's a sense a little bit that we're on the other side of what was potentially a massive crisis in terms of the way that our government was going to respond to the protests. I think in many respects, we are still seeing, you know, we are seeing sort of the first wave of response this week we saw from cities, from Congress, even the Republicans in the Senate, you know, much of it insufficient, inadequate, but at least there was a response for the most part to what's happening. I mean, things seem to we're living in a really in many respects terrible, but also incredibly dynamic time right now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's overwhelming, really. And I think it's interesting because I think a lot of our assumptions that we would normally have made about any one of these events that have taken place are being exploded because, as you point out, it's so dynamic. I just don't think anybody really knows anymore. And then the normal sort of, you know, rules that you would think about any kind of a political event, like, you know, for the protest, for instance, and the reaction to the death of George Floyd and the way that the whole thing has unfolded over the last couple of weeks. I mean, it's hard to believe that, I mean, George, you know, this is so recent, and the uprising has been so spontaneous and so so sustained and profound. And the amount of, you know, the institutional reaction in local governments and in corporate America and, you know, across the board has been amazing. And we don't know where it's going. I mean, there's, you know, you can tell that on the right, and you have Trump and you have Fox News and things like that, that they're banking on a backlash and right, actually trying to fan one. So far, that hasn't materialized in any substantial way other than coming from him. And, you know, but I think, you know, what I think we would have assumed would happen in a situation like this has not unfolded the way in any way the way that I think I might have predicted. I mean, the fact that, you know, the president coming out last week and doing his photo op and making, you know, taking a stand as the, quote, law and order president. And by the way, we shouldn't be surprised by his stance on that. This is a guy who wrote an op-ed back in the 1980s, many decades ago that was entitled Bring Back the Death Penalty, Bring Back the Police. And, you know, if anybody hasn't read that ad recently, they really should, because it encapsulates Donald Trump's worldview when it comes to policing. If you ever had any doubts about where he stands on it, I think that pretty much clears it up. And you can say the same thing for Bill Barr. So that part of it, though, which I think many people might have thought would be that backlash would be showing itself by now in a more substantial way than Trump's Twitter feed, that hasn't materialized. So, I mean, here we are, and, you're seeing day after day more and more kind of institutional reaction, things like NASCAR banning the Confederate flag. I mean, did you predict that? Because I certainly didn't. I mean, that's a cultural sort of touchstone that says something fundamental. I mean, I don't want to give them too much credit. They shouldn't have had it there in the first place. But nonetheless, it's meaningful that they are stepping up in this moment and not, fighting back, which is what I would have expected.
Yeah, I guess I'm stuck on this theory that in many respects, what we're seeing, I think it's highly contextual insofar as, this is happening during the shutdown during the Trump administration. But I also think that some of this, there was a certain inevitability, right? Or at least the broader context had been set by these type of changes in our society, at least, and they're not, let's be honest, the changes are not huge yet, but the attitudes are certainly, like you say, have evolved and are different than one would have anticipated, 6 months ago or a year ago or whenever. And I think a lot of this is a function of, frankly, millennials are the largest generation we have now. And, I think Gen X, which I'm, just a part of, we did not have much influence over society, society's norms. I think we were very much drowned out by boomers who grew up, in an era that was very different. I mean, boomers saw the need for the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. And, these things, millennials are just growing up in a completely different era, and their expectations of society are that much more, have progressed that much more. And now they actually have the literal size in which their views carry the day, as consumers, as citizens, as managers, as media mavens, that's I think what we're seeing is a product, at least to some extent, of that generation and the younger generation, sort of taking control over at least this part of the discourse.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, and it's kind of interesting. You bring up the boomer experience, and I was reminded, when I was looking at these corporate reactions, Procter and Gamble, and various other, that you might think that, why do they want it? Why would they want to get involved in this? Well, what they're seeing is that I don't know if people watch Mad Men, if you watch that show, but the final part of the show was the sort of changing of the old guard of the 1950s into that brand new world of the boomers in the late 60s. And in the final episodes, you had the Don Draper, the ad guy, being inspired by what he saw at a commune retreat in Big Sur in California. Right. And the impression was that he went back and wrote the Diet Coke, the Coca-Cola ad, "I'd like to teach the world to sing." And all the people in the ad looked just like the people who were in the Big Sur thing. The reason I bring that up is because what that was a recognition that you had this gigantic new generation that were also going to be consumers, and they were also sort of defining what it was they wanted to consume. And I'm not defending the idea of the corporate world, co-opting these ideas. is. I'm just saying that I think that you're right.
It's illustrative of that.
Yes, and it just, and I think that what you're seeing now, and this is a very important aspect of the huge millennial generation exerting their cultural power. And one of the things that defines them, and you see it in the protests and you see it everywhere, is that this is a truly multicultural, multiracial generation in a way that the boomers weren't. They were still mostly white in America. This new generation is not. I mean, it is, you know, you're going to, when is it changing in America? It's like within the next decade or something. It's not going to be majority white anymore. This generation is not majority white. And so these issues that are coming to the fore, this the idea of Black Lives Matter suddenly becoming a mainstream idea, in the culture, you know, forget politics. Let's just talk about how it is affecting the culture itself, you know, writ large. That's largely a reflection of the fact that this is a generation that just, you know, white supremacy is not part of their own generational experience. I mean, it certainly is in the world and our politics and the way that, you know, our society has been structured, but they're looking around at each other, and you look at these protests, and you do not see a white crowd there. Plenty of white people there, of course, but plenty of black people, plenty of brown people, plenty of gay people. I mean, it's a much more multi-cultural, multi-ethnic, multi-racial demographic. And that is going to be making a difference. And I think everybody's, you know, we're seeing this sort of jolt into reality just in this, you know, one experience that we're having here. But this is the beginning of that, not the end. I mean, this is going to be the first of many of these reckonings that we're going to see.
Well, I don't know if it's the first.
At the hands of the millennials.
Me too could be considered to be,
true.
You know, of
yeah,
this,
you're right.
To be, you know, one of those moments of reckoning. And, you know, I don't want to overstate the implications of these things, because I have very little doubt, you know, like on the Majority Report this week, I was talking to Alex Vitale, who's been quite a, you know, people have become far more aware of him in the past, you know, week or two, because he has written a book about basically, you know, getting rid of policing. And I think at least part of his prescription is really he's talking more about an abolitionist framework rather than calling for the abolition of police departments. The big thing, obviously, is this notion of defunding or disinvesting from the police and reinvesting in other mechanisms to deal with problems that have been basically shoved onto the police portfolio. I think it's quite possible. We were talking about Minneapolis, and I think it's quite possible in a year from now, the Minneapolis City Council, as things have died down, aren't going to take the steps that they're sort of implying that they're taking now. But nevertheless, there is without a doubt a change in perspective that is taking place culturally, and it's having implications politically, like you started to say, which is, you know, Donald Trump gets up there and talks about law and order, and everybody's like, you're out of your mind. And the police themselves also seem to be, and I think, you know, I would not be surprised if we find out 6 to 8 months from now or a year from now that there was a broad coordination amongst these big city mayors, Democrats, Republicans alike, that their response was not necessarily coordinated, but they learned from each other. We saw some of that during Occupy out of these Homeland Security fusion centers, because the police were atrocious and could not have made a better argument in support of what the protesters were protesting than they did, frankly, by their actions. And so it remains to be seen how much change is going to happen. But I think clearly, you know, what we are seeing is the beginning part of a series of dominoes, and I'm not even sure I could pick out what those dominoes are that are going to follow over the next, I think, couple of decades in terms of what we see culturally, but also politically. And I think to a certain extent, there is a sense, you know, we're going from 30,000 feet to, you know, closer to ground level in the White House over the past couple of weeks, that they have a severe problem in terms of, like, you know, whatever they thought was going to help them win this election. Joe Biden is opening up a significant lead, one that is sort of unprecedented. Now, you know, anything can happen, but there is this sort of, like, quality that's out there that that people are starting to realize. And I have to say, even on the Democratic side, the image of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer taking a knee and yep. wearing a dashiki was, you know, I mean, it was pretty performative. And I think a lot of people sort of knew that and were like, we better see some substance as well. And I think, like, we're in those situations, we see the sort of generational divide in terms of response, right? Like, it's not going to be quite enough to paint Black Lives Matter on the streets of Washington. There's got to be substantive material benefits and material change.
Absolutely. And, you know, although I'm going to give them credit for even doing the performative, which I might not have even expected. I mean, you know, okay, do something. At least that's a step in the right direction. You and I have been talking about this for months, the fact that, you know, there's just been almost paralysis.
Right. Right.
And silence on the part of the Democrats. So I'm seeing some movement. Maybe they're seeing some opportunity maybe to, advance some of their agenda within this kind of, you know, dynamic situation. So, you know, I'll just say I'm hopeful that maybe we'll see something better than what we've been seeing, and that's not saying much. But, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the agenda is going to have to grow a lot. I mean, there's no going back to the idea of, you know, like, well, maybe if we just, you know, fight the Republicans on the capital gains tax cut. I mean, this is like that whole part, that whole sort of, I don't know how to even describe it. It was kind of this sense that there was just inertia in politics, polarization creating nothingness in politics. Well, that can't happen anymore. And in some ways, you know, Trump has sort of has made that possible, because by coming in, and first of all, you know, the Republican Party is a wreck. And as you say, the polling is looking, pretty amazing, all things considered. But, you know, Trump sort of coasted along for 3.5 years, kind of dealing with problems of his own making. And they were all kind of public relations problems, all messaging, you know, even the impeachment was to some extent a rank partisan problem within the political system. This is something completely different between the pandemic, the economic, you know, meltdown that ensued because of it, and now this massive social unrest. He is showing himself completely inadequate to the task of being president at a time like this. And I think that, you know, people are starting to sober up a little bit. And, you know, the idea that this opens up this window for the new generation of political leaders to take their cues from the culture and step in and be able to push hard. And, you know, 2018 was very helpful in that. We elected a bunch of people into the Democratic Party, into the progressive side of and even the frontline, you know, sort of mealy-mouthed moderates that were elected in 2018 are more, you know, progressive than we've ever seen the mealy-mouthed moderate coalition in the Democratic Party be,
and more partisan, which is obviously I would like them progressive and partisan, but if they're more partisan, it helps push progressive ideas, because
absolutely
there's another rail that they don't want to cross on some level, and that they
well and there's a sense of solidarity within the party that's good for them as well as being good, you know, on the policy side. And, you know, you're going to end up seeing, too, as this Republican Party, you know, is kind of imploding. And there is, you know, there if they lose any majority, if by some miracle the Democrats are able to take the Senate, the Republican Party, you know, fighting against them is going to be easy, and we're going to see I think you and I are both prepared for what's going to happen, right? There's going to be a huge argument in the Democratic Party. That is going to happen. That's something that has to happen. And the fact that there's that kind of partisanship makes that okay. I think it's safe for us to have that argument. It's long overdue. I think the Democratic Party is ready to have it, and that, you know, you and I are going to be talking a lot about that over the next, you know, years as we see that play out. And that's fine. I mean, I you know, that's politics. You know, you want that to happen. And what we're seeing sort of as we're going into this election, we're seeing those kinds of battle lines being drawn, I think, within the context of a political world in which we cannot take a chance on Donald Trump. I mean, I'm really happy about this because, you know, normally the Democrats would have gone the other way. Oh, my God, we've got to get rid of Donald Trump. Let's be as right-wing as we can.
Right.
You know, we've got to get those right-wingers. We've got to go up to, you know, Macomb County in Michigan and get those Reagan Democrats back. I mean, that has been the mantra for decades now, that the only way to win in this country was to move to the right for Democrats. Well, that's over, finally. And, you know, some of that has to do with the fact that the Republicans have done this to themselves. They lost touch with the mainstream of American life. Some of it has to do with this generational change that we were talking about. And some of it has to do with hard-won experience by the Democratic Party, that there, you know, some people have recognized that just was not working. And with the implosion under Donald Trump, you know, here's the opportunity for that to happen. Now, I don't think it's going to be easy, but I do think that these ideas like, you know, like defund the police and that sort of thing, you know, that Overton window, if you believe in that stuff at all, it's a huge window and it's wide open now. And there's a lot of stuff that people are going to be able to start talking about.
I mean, I think in many respects, we're getting a glimpse of if, knock on wood, Joe Biden wins, and if, knock on wood, Donald Trump vacates the White House,
right.
You know, as we get closer to that, I think you and I are going to be talking significantly about how this is not going to be over on the Tuesday of the election. It is, I think we're going to have a version of what we saw in 2000. Where the election was not resolved for over a month and a half,
right,
and close to 2 months, and I think we're going to see a version of that, and I don't know that it's going to be because it was close. Frankly, it could be because a whole myriad of things, but we will get to that later, and maybe we can also talk about the military a little bit in that regard, in the way that they acted this past week. But before we do, I want to say that, you know, it's interesting because Joe Biden came out with a proposal this week for police reform that involved actually funding police by another $300 million. And that is, regardless of where it goes in the, you know, whether it hires more cops or not, that runs really counter to what the zeitgeist is, which is, you know, over the past 40 years, because Reagan closed the institutions, mental institutions, because we have an increasing homeless problem, in a myriad of other things. The police have expanded their portfolio, essentially, and it has not worked out. And what we need to do is actually the opposite, is decrease their portfolio, allow them to do like more detective work and less sort of policing work, as it were. I don't think Joe Biden's going to pay a significant price for being so out of step. I think it's, you know, within the sort of like realm of, you know, people's expectation. You know, he's talking about something that, you know, his proposal, hopefully by then it's out of his hands, you know, or it's already, the ship has already sailed on that. But it's going to be interesting because we're setting up a scenario that's going to be very, very different if Joe Biden wins than it was when Barack Obama won.
Absolutely.
On day one, I think you're going to see, I think you're going to see Democrats, people on the street, they're going to be pushing this administration very, very hard.
Yep.
And the idea that, you know, the real question to me will be how, because you mentioned like it was a bit of a surprise that they didn't go rushing to, you know, to chase after conservatives. And that's because mm-hmm. of Donald Trump. If Donald Trump is gone, do they revert to that? I don't think they can do, they can revert
I
as successfully.
I don't think they can either.
Well, but I think they're going to try.
Yeah.
You know,
some will, for sure.
You know, I'm just, Chris Coons mm-hmm. being Joe Biden's top surrogate is a real concern to me, frankly. And so that's going to be one of the things to watch out. But we get ahead of ourselves, I think, in talking about that right now. Let's talk about what you wrote about this week, which was the military's reaction to Donald Trump. And I mean, I was really struck by this because it is quite clear, you know, like there's always been this question of, you know, how will the military respond if Donald Trump does that thing? And it was at least encouraging to see their response over the past week or two. Simultaneously, rather scary to see how the administration will react by going and creating essentially a federal secret police force. I don't know what else you would call it. You know, people showing up without an insignia.
Yeah, that federal police force is Bill Barr's baby. He did the same thing in 1992 when during the LA riots. I wrote a whole piece about it. His behavior in 1992 is exactly the same as it was this time. His reaction to the only difference is that instead of Antifa, in 1992 he blamed street gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, for the violence and what was going on, and that there really wasn't any outpouring of anger and frustration at the police. This was just an opportunistic gang-related thing. Same thing with this time, just chose a different, you know, outside agitator. So that part of it, I think, is really vested in him. The difference then, between then and now, is that it was a different president. And the president in 1992, Bush Sr., he wasn't having it. He wasn't interested in Barr's ideas. He let him gather some federal troops. They got a plane together and they picked up some FBI agents and Bureau of Prisons and some other, just as they did this time. And they brought them to L.A., which I never knew that actually happened. But they did. But there was a very small presence. There weren't very many. And, of course, you know, they did send in active duty troops to L.A. under the Insurrection Act at the request of the governor. And I don't believe that was even really controversial at the time, because the whole thing, the National Guard didn't have its act together and nobody knew what to do. And they kind of, everybody agreed that was okay. And nothing really resulted from that was considered controversial. This time, of course, from what I gather from reading these various TikToks that have come out in the last few days about that day on Monday when the protest happened, when they pushed everybody back from Lafayette Park across from the White House, is that Trump, you know, spent the weekend, I think he was terrified. The bunker thing that happened on Friday night, right. Them actually taking him down there and pushing him in the bunker, I think scared him to death. And he watched TV and watched the protests growing and watched the looting in the, you know, in LA that happened and various things that weekend. And on Monday, he had worked himself up into a frenzy, and that's when he got on the phone to the governor, said, "You have to dominate, and if you won't do it, I'm sending in, you know, I will send in the military." And he, at that time, he indicated that, you know, General Milley I'm gonna unleash. I can't use the word unleash. Something like that. I'm gonna unleash Millie and I'm gonna unleash Bill Barr. You know, right. And they were both there when he made the call. Clearly, Trump was really, you know, overwhelmed and very, very agitated. So what I got from this, though, was as they were trying to figure out what to do, mostly what they were doing was to try and keep Trump from calling in the active duty military. They had the 82nd Airborne on standby. He wanted them on the streets. So even Barr, as much as he was, you know, sort of ready to bring in his you know, his secret federal uninsignied police into the streets, was concerned about the military part of it, at least to the extent that he said, we don't want to house them in the city limits. Let's right. leave them outside and see if we need them. In any case, according to this story, they were, you know, they brought in National Guard from all over the country. They had an armory filled with live ammunition they were yep. going to use on the protesters. And the military this whole time was just trying desperately to keep him from giving that order. So I think that that was part of what, you know, fueled that ridiculous thing that happened that night. You and I talked about this. We both thought that they did that aggressive move against the protesters, knowing that it was all being held live just before the president spoke. It was so that he could see it, and that the country could see that they were dominating, which was the message of the day. Right. We're going to dominate, and so they did that. I think Milley put on his battle fatigues. Maybe Trump yep. told him that he wanted him in the streets, but I think he probably did it in order to say, "Okay, look, you know, we're doing this." Barr strutting around like, you know, some kind of, you know, generalissimo in the park, looking, you know, reviewing the troops, and they did their march over to the church, and all that stuff was done in an absolutely, you know, kind of terrified response on their part to keep Trump from losing his mind and setting up this constitutional crisis. I think we were on the brink of him ordering troops to do something the troops were going to say was an unlawful order. And if that's the truth, I don't know that, but or maybe that wasn't even spoken, but it was some kind of subtext to what was going on that day. But that was a very, very dangerous day. And Milley and the rest of the military, you know, I mean, I'm no pro-military person, and, you know, I'm not trying to give him any credit. But I think that it's possible that he, in that moment, decided that the lesser of two evils was to appease Trump by putting on his uniform and marching around. If that would keep him happy and he didn't give that order, maybe he figured that was the best thing to do and waited for everything to calm down a little bit and for him to come out and because he had to say something. I'm sure it's clear that with all the statements coming from the retired generals and admirals over the last week, including General Mattis, that there was tremendous unrest within the brass of the military. They were saying Definitely. That on behalf of the active duty brass. Of course they were. They wouldn't have done that. You know, I mean, in that sort of, it was almost coordinated, right? I assume they were talking to each other.
Right.
That because the active duty couldn't do it, they would have to resign before
Exactly.
they could do it. So, you know, this was clearly the military, you know, saying, up to the point of either saying, we will not follow your unlawful order, or resigning en masse, this was what they had to do. And, you know, just think about that. You know, Donald Trump got scared one night because of some protesters out, and, you know, come on. You know, I guess they set a fire in the church, somebody did, and that scared him to death. And it almost came to that him giving an order that was either going to be a constitutional crisis or they follow it through and put active duty military with apparently live ammunition. And, you know, right. and there's a whole lot about this that we don't know yet exactly what happened. They're doing investigations, like the National Guard put those helicopters up. Nobody knows who gave the order to buzz those protesters the way that they do in, you know, Fallujah or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, snapping trees off and sending glass flying and doing all that to disperse the protesters. They don't know if it was the helicopter pilots or who knows, maybe Bill Barr. I wouldn't be surprised. He was in the command center, you know, giving orders. So this is a very, very, that event And, of course, it didn't work out for Trump at all. The photo op was a complete bust as far as his, you know, helping him in any way. That whole thing is a very scary moment, and it's kind of indicative of the fact that, you know, we really have a madman in the White House.
Yep.
That, you know, I think he's being enabled in a million ways, and, you know, you see it, these people are spending all their time trying to contain him. You know, I think even the public health people are doing that. I think that's what Dr. Anthony Fauci does, you know, trying to, okay, just keep him calm and say something, you know, don't get him upset and,
right.
You know, try and keep him okay. And, you know, this is what we're dealing with here. So, you know, you look at that and you're kind of going, well, you know, okay, Joe Biden, shut up, don't get in trouble, and, you know, we'll deal with you later. Right now we have to, you know, it's imperative to get this guy out, because this is a crisis that this man cannot handle. Obviously.
Right. And, you know, I don't know if everybody has seen the that meme out there where the aliens are lined up and they're like, oh, we're up next. I'm scared, or something to that effect.
I haven't seen it. But I'll have to look that
but,
up.
But there is a real quality to, like, you know, we are still 5 months out. Almost close to the day, probably, of the election. And I imagine we're in for some rough times ahead, which is not to even say anything about, you know, what we may deal with potentially with the economy. I mean, we are, you know, we didn't talk about this, but I suspect, sadly, we're going to have the opportunity to talk about it next week. There are essentially new unprecedented numbers of cases and hospitalizations in Arizona and Texas this week. Arizona is near the brink of their capacity. By the time we talk next week, it's not inconceivable that they would have overshot it. This is in California. There's a highest number of cases, and about three or four, maybe another half a dozen states that are seeing more infections as a function of Memorial Day. And we, you know, anything can happen going forward. We could see maybe states having to shut down again. And buckle up, folks. Stay
exactly.
Tight and stay safe. Heather, as always, we will talk more about these things, I'm sure, next week. Thank you so much. Always, always helpful for me, and sometimes hopeful.
But, well, my pleasure. Wish we could be more hopeful these days, but, you know, it is what it is.
We shall see. Thanks so much, Heather.
You're welcome.
Congresswoman Karen Maloney has served in the House since 1993. She is currently the House Chairman on Oversight and Reform. But that hasn't made her immune to challengers in her district who are pushing her from the left. Here to discuss why she's challenging Congresswoman Maloney in New York's 12th District, Lauren Ashcraft. So, Lauren, you're running in New York's 12th District. Before we get into some of the issues of the race and who you're running against, tell us about New York's 12th.
Absolutely. So it's a really diverse district, and it's the east side of Manhattan, Western Queens, North Brooklyn, and Roosevelt Island. And it has so many gig workers and freelancers and people that are working really hard to be here. And also the average age is 35. So we're seeing a lot of people that are just buried in student debt the rest of their lives as well. But it's hard to pay your rent in this district normally, but add on to this a pandemic and skyrocketing unemployment. This district is over 71% renters, and we haven't successfully canceled the rent at any level of government yet. So this district is struggling and struggling really hard. And that is exactly why I'm running for Congress, is we haven't had the kind of vocal advocacy we need at the federal level, making sure that we have the help we need to get through these tough times and be able to live with dignity always. So it is why I'm running, and I'm fighting for the working people of my district to have that representation.
And that really is, I mean, there's quite a diversity there in terms of I would imagine both socioeconomically, but just in terms of age and across the board. I mean, knowing those three separate areas. Tell us about the person who you're running against, the incumbent, because I know she's been in office for an extraordinarily long time. And I can tell you that those three parts of New York City were radically different in many respects over the past three decades.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, she's been in office for 27 years, and she's kept in office by the hundreds of thousands of dollars of corporate PAC money she takes every cycle. And this cycle has already been $700,000, and we haven't seen her latest report yet.
So, and we should say we're talking about Carolyn Maloney, but go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Carolyn Maloney has been our representative for 27 years, and she often she talks about her experience as the reason that she is entitled to the seat. I always like to dispel that myth. The seat belongs to nobody but the people. So I do believe in primarying representatives, obviously, but she doesn't deserve the seat, and I'll tell you why. Let's talk about her experience that she often references. She voted for the crime bill, and that set the precedent for how people of color are treated across our country even today, and it expanded and accelerated mass incarceration and increased the number of people that have been killed by the death penalty federally. So it was a terrible bill, and whenever she's pressed on it, she says a lot of other Democrats voted for it as well. That's not an excuse. And it also shows we need somebody who thinks critically about every single bill that crosses her desk and doesn't just follow everyone else. And I would have appreciated if she did do that with bills that have called for the demilitarization of police and ending racial profiling and requiring body cams to be active and on for all police officers. But bills like that have passed by without her co-sponsoring for over a year. And within the last 2 weeks, she's finally moved on them. But we don't need somebody who gets politically pressured into doing the right thing. We need somebody who's always going to be fighting on behalf of their constituents. And that's just not what she's done. She's also helped to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, which left us wide open to the 2008 Great Recession. And we need somebody who's going to stand up for us rather than sell us out to corporations for their profit. And because of my experience in the financial sector, I am really ready to go and understand how that sector works and want to use my experience to help properly regulate the financial sector so that we aren't the ones that bail them out whenever they make irresponsible decisions like in 2008. She also voted for the Iraq War. I'm staunchly anti-war. And my grandmother actually was a survivor of the United States dropping a bomb on Japan, which is where she's from. And she fought cancer multiple times after that attack because of the radiation. And you can't just lightly vote for war knowing, you know, the number of people that are going to pay the consequences for the rest of their lives. And again, we see that she's followed what, you know, other Democrats have done around her. We need somebody who's going to stand up for us. And, you know, she has voted to increase the military budget. She's helped to fund ICE. It's just like, you can call yourself a progressive, but this does not look like a progressive record. And I am running on single-payer Medicare for All for a Green New Deal, canceling student debt. I'm running for true criminal justice reform and to make sure that we are prioritizing people over profit at the federal level, which we absolutely will not see if we keep putting people into office who are funded by corporate PACs.
And, you know, and that's a mouthful, Lauren. And but one thing that we should also make clear, I mean, this is a very very blue district, right? I mean, there is no Republican who's going to win here. Obviously, a Republican hasn't won here in over 27 years.
Exactly.
And so this is one where we should have a very progressive Democrat, and we just simply don't have it here.
Exactly. Yep. And it's this corporate PAC money that's really just paying for her to sit in that seat. So that is why we've been working so hard. We're proud to say that we have the most small dollars raised in the race. So our we've raised over six figures, and our average donation is about $16. So we've been working really hard and have been able to reach a lot of voters through mail and digitally and over the phone and text. And we're really excited for these final weeks of the race because we're getting people that, you know, haven't voted in previous elections or have voted and are just really excited to fill in the dot next to my name. So we do have a movement behind us for sure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about two things. They're interrelated. I want to talk about what, in addition to your issue set, I mean, what qualifies you to run? We've got multiple other people who are running. Why are you the choice that people should go and choose and support to unseat this, you know, with all due respect, ossified incumbent? I mean, 27 years she's been there, and I don't know anybody who could be in the same job for 27 years and really still have the hunger and the passion and, frankly, the awareness of who her constituency is at this point. But why you, as opposed to some of the people you're running in the primary?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, we're really proud to have the support of organizations like Brand New Congress and New York Progressive Action Network that have recognized our campaign and my background for the on-the-ground organizing we've done. I come from a background of fighting for our rights on the streets, and I've helped to organize the Women's March on New York and also led justice committees fighting for gender justice and social equality. So, you know, that background in organizing also combined with my experience of working in the financial sector, seeing the belly of the beast and literally becoming a democratic socialist inside of a bank. I am really ready to go in fighting corporate greed. And I am ready to bring my experience and passion and also experience organizing and connecting with on the ground movements and activists. And that is really how we can get stuff done. I've seen people change their minds because of, you know, raising awareness around Medicare for All on the ground. And I've seen people be really passionate about the Green New Deal after having a conversation with somebody who is fighting for it. So this is how we make people aware of the issues that are most urgent right now. And it's also how we change votes and replace representatives across the country so we can really get stuff done with people-powered representatives on the inside.
I got to say, I took a look at some of the people who've endorsed you. I was really impressed. You've got folks like Brand New Congress, Paula Jean Swearingen, who just won her primary in West Virginia.
Yes, Shahid, I'm so excited.
Shahid Buttar, who's running against Nancy Pelosi. I just had him on the Majority Report. He's fantastic. Blue America. Of course, those guys have been around for a long time, looking for Democrats who are going to fight for Democrats. There's many others. Women for Justice and New York Youth Climate Strike. Give me a sense of A, what you need to do, but how what you need to do to win has changed.
Yeah.
I know you know, you were on this program. You spoke to Farron Cousins. I think I was out that day. But I imagine the strategy that you had to win 6 months ago has got to change, because one of the things a progressive challenger has that the incumbent doesn't is usually a lot more excitement on the ground. And now in this instance with the ground, you can't be you can't be out there, obviously, because we're in the middle of a pandemic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is, it's one of the greatest honors of my whole life, to be completely honest, is watching my team do what it does. And I'm really, it's amazing because a lot of them started out as volunteers. And then whenever we started to fundraise, they've become paid staff, and we've switched to being 100% digital. Just right after we decided to no longer petition and get signatures because we felt we had enough and the health of our community was much more important to us. And since then, we've been digital. So we have digital ads. We've sent mailers through union printers. We have been doing phone and text banking and reach multiple thousand people per day through that effort as well. And we've been really lucky to have a really amazing and growing team of volunteers. We have about 500 people that have signed up to volunteer with us throughout the campaign. And they are the people that sign on and do those calls and texts with us and crunch the data on the back end. And it's sometimes I watch it all work and it's really humbling. And I'm proud to be part of this team. And we really focused around the health and what's best for our community right now. And they're making it work. And what we need to do to win is to continue to spread the word and let people know they do have a choice in this election. And we're finding that whenever we connect with people, the majority of the people we connect with are really excited about our campaign and are committed to voting for us. So it is just a matter of making sure they know they have an option.
What's your feeling in terms of, you know, we have a couple other races. I'm thinking of, I think it's New York 12th, where Jamal Bowman is taking on Elliot Engel. I know that we've had some consolidation there where a couple of folks running in the race, progressives, have dropped out to make sure that a progressive basically takes that seat. I think we have it, Mondaire, Jones, I think is his name, is starting to consolidate a little bit too. What's your sense about in this instance? I mean, how many of, there's a DSA candidate, I believe, in this race as well. And we have, Patel who ran against, Maloney, I think it was in 2018. I think he got about 40% of the vote. I mean, what's your sense? If you had a plea to make to your supporters and your opponents in terms of, you know, why you have the best shot of knocking Maloney out of this seat, what would it be in terms of that consolidation?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should all look at why we got in the race in the first place. And I know I've spoken with all the other challengers that have been running. We should all keep in mind why we got involved in the first place. And a lot of the people that did vote against Maloney in 2018 are voting for us. And they've said that they, you know, were looking for a way to oppose her. And were, you know, they voted against her in 2018, and now they see the vision and the movement behind our campaign. So I am really honored to have received the endorsements that we have and honored to have the most individual donors in the race, the most volunteers, and we do have that path to victory. But I do ask, you know, if unseating Representative Maloney is the goal of all of the challengers in the race. I do, you know, you're welcome on my team, and I would love to really do this together.
Give me a sense of how the I mean, on one hand, you know, COVID taketh away, but also giveth in many respects, because it seems to me that while it is maybe inhibited a challenger's ability to campaign in this instance, it's also, it seems to me, focused people's attention on sort of like the failures of society that, you know, really get laid bare in a crisis like this. Give me your sense of what you're hearing from people when you make these calls in your district as to maybe how their what is important to them has changed.
Yeah, I mean, we could have never imagined everything that would be, you know, coming to a head in these last few months of the race. A pandemic, a real crisis with police brutality and mass protests and everything. We're hearing desperation when we call people, and we're hearing that people cannot pay for their rent right now. We've reached a lot of people and they've literally had to move out of the city, which is heartbreaking because they're leaving everything they know and they have behind. And people don't have health insurance. We've called people and they have recently lost loved ones to COVID-19. It's really, really heartbreaking. And our campaign is really proud to have dedicated a lot of our time to participating in mutual aid and making sure that we're helping people have the food they need at this time and directing them to other resources that they may need. And that is a constant reminder of why we're doing this, is nobody should be hungry. Nobody should have to worry if they're going to have to leave the city or live on the street. These are basic human rights that every other industrialized country has. But we have prioritized in this country profit over people for so long. And it's a horrible idea that corporations are allowed to continue to throw money at our politicians because they take that and they ignore us. And it is why one of the first things I want to do when I'm in Congress is push for public financing of federal elections, because we should reward candidates that reject that money. And we should incentivize it with matching and also show that, you know, if you accept corporate and super PAC money, you're not fighting for the people and you can't get the kind of rewards that people who reject that kind of influence do.
Well, it sounds great. We've got now, I guess, about 2 weeks or so before the election. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, one day less than 2 weeks. So it's really the get out the vote time. And if you're listening, definitely check us out at laurenashcraft.com. And every single vote really, really makes a difference because it is a grassroots campaign and we are up against a 27-year incumbent.
And people can go online. They can fill out an absentee ballot request form. They simply need to put in a temporary illness, which the city and the state is now considering a legitimate, temporary illness in terms of just being a concern about COVID-19, which the city and state is now considering an okay reason for requesting an absentee ballot, and it will be mailed to them. And so if you're hearing the sound of my voice, even shortly after this or this podcast or video is released, you have plenty of time to get that ballot mailed to you, and you just got to get it back into the mail before the 23rd, I think it is.
Yeah, it has to be postmarked by the 22nd if you're mailing it back. And you're very right. If you're in New York City, you could go to nycabsentee.com. It takes maybe 20 seconds to fill out that request, and you have until June 16th to make that request for an absentee ballot. So definitely do that. We're pushing for people to do it via mail because it is the safest way for you to use your voice right now.
Lauren Ashcroft, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on the show and everything you do to help amplify this movement. Thank you so much, Sam.
You can find out more about Lauren Ashcraft over at laurenashcraft.com. Last year in August of 2019, I sat down and interviewed Mondaire Jones. At the time, he was running against Nita Lowey in New York's 17th district. She since announced her retirement, and three other candidates jumped into the race, actually four or five, but the two of them have dropped out and have endorsed Mondaire Jones, as has AOC and just about every progressive organization in the country. He is now running in a four-way race. Polling has showed that race extremely close. Listen to Mondaire Jones from almost a year ago, and then head over to his website and support him in his race in New York 17th. The primary is coming up in just less than 2 weeks. So, Mondaire, why don't you just first give us a sense of, and we should say that this, we're talking to you in the context of a series that we're doing of folks who are challenging sitting Democrats in primaries. And this has been, you know, certainly a more, a kinetic topic, particularly since AOC unseated the one of the members of the Democratic leadership, and that has had a lot of very positive effects, I think, people feel for progressives. Give me a sense of why you decided to enter into this race.
I decided to enter into this race because people in my district are struggling. You have folks like my grandmother, folks of a different generation who are working well past the age of retirement just to pay for the high cost of prescription drugs and medical procedures. You got people like my mother when I was growing up, at least, who worked multiple jobs just to make ends meet, even with the help of the Section 8 housing voucher. And then you have people in my generation. I'm 32 years old, and so many people I know around my age who still live in this district are living at home with their parents because they can't afford to pay rent or to pay for the high cost of buying a home. And we have someone in Congress, and in fact many members of the Democratic caucus, unfortunately, who are not fighting hard enough for the big policy items that are going to address those problems, like Medicare for All, a Green New Deal, student debt forgiveness. And in addition to not fighting for that, they're not holding this president accountable. I mean, I'm running against someone for whom I have great respect. She's the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. But if I were in her role, I would not have given $7.6 billion to ICE. I would not have had to be challenged for the first time in 30 years before I reversed my position on the issue of impeachment. And I would have fought to give tax relief under the salt cap deduction to the folks in this district who pay the highest property taxes in the entire country. So I think we can walk and chew gum. It's not just about challenging Republicans. We can challenge ourselves to do better as a Democratic Party. And, you know, my responsibility is raising the expectations of people in this district, of their leaders.
So tell me a little bit about New York's 17th congressional district, just so that folks around the country can take to get a notion of it and what they should be expecting from a congressman from a New York district.
This district is a district in which I was born and raised. I live in Nyack, which is in the county of Rockland. That's about 40% of the district. The other 60% is comprised of parts of central and northern Westchester. And this is a working class district. Median household income is $95,000, so it's a little more affluent than many other districts, but still working class and middle to upper middle class. And folks here are people who are progressive Democrats for the most part, especially if you look at the polling. And this is a safely blue district. In fact, in 2018, Republicans did not so much as field a challenger to the incumbent in this race.
And she's been, Nita Lowey, she has been in this seat for how long now?
Since 1989, so exactly 30 years.
Wow.
And has never had a primary challenger since that time.
Wow. And so this is about as safe of a blue district as you can get. I mean, New York, I think we still have a couple of Republican holdouts, but certainly not this close to the city. Nyack is not even, well, 45 minutes, depends on the traffic, I guess, in terms of getting to New York City. But the bottom line is, and this is why I think this race is so relevant to folks who are not from the 17th district. And that is because we need congresspeople who are in the bluest of blue districts to be on the vanguard of doing things like you've been talking about. And give me your sense of like what your experience has been in terms of politics. I mean, you're 32. This is it's your generation. We sort of skipped mine in a large respects, went from the boomers to the millennials. And I got no problem with that, knowing my generation, with all due respect to me and to my generation. But give us a sense of your experience that you've had at this point, because you've packed a lot into those 32 years.
That's right, and many, my apologies to your generation for jumping the gun a bit.
No, thank you.
I was born and raised in this district, was born at Nyack Hospital, raised in the village of Spring Valley, which is a working class district. My political awakening really came when I was in high school, and I saw as a public school student in the East Ramapo Central School District how difficult it was to get, even then, a school budget passed. And I thought to myself, it's really important that I mobilize people. So I reactivated the Spring Valley NAACP Youth Council, got out the vote, registered folks to vote. And a few years later, ended up joining the national board for the NAACP and chairing a committee at the age of 19. Wow. I was really active in progressive causes at Stanford University, where I fought for things like faculty and graduate student diversity, a living wage for maintenance and dining hall workers, and even obtained some policing reforms as a senior at Stanford University when the Palo Alto police chief at the time, before she resigned, we got her to resign, made comments supportive of racial profiling. After graduating from Stanford University, where I had been active in student government, I joined the Obama administration. I worked in the Office of Legal Policy at the Department of Justice, where I vetted candidates for federal judgeships and even worked on Justice Kagan's nomination, and also worked on criminal justice reform for an attorney general that actually cared about those things, which I'm very proud to say, and subsequently went to Harvard Law School, where as a 3L, provided free legal services to indigent defendants, folks who could not afford to pay for representation. And I saw firsthand how people are over-arrested, over-prosecuted, and over-sentenced, primarily people of color and low-income people. I then decided to get some of the best training I can get by going to work at a law firm where I also at the same time could pay down the $120,000 in student debt from law school, and where I also worked, spent hundreds of hours investigating claims of employment discrimination and helping people who had been defrauded during the financial crisis get some of their money back. And was very proud to say that I was awarded by the Legal Aid Society of New York for the pro bono work that I did in that capacity. More recently, I founded a nonprofit called Rising Leaders, which provides professional skills to underserved middle school students in three different American cities, in Harlem and in Washington, D.C., and in Seattle. We recently received a grant from the Gates Foundation earlier this year. And more recently, I also worked as a litigator in the Westchester County Law Department, where I litigated some of the county's largest cases and served as a legal advisor to the county executive, to the Westchester County Board of Legislators, and also to the Westchester County Human Rights Commission. And have also been serving at now, by leave of absence, on the board of the New York Civil Liberties Union. So I'm very proud of the work that I've been doing over the past 32 years. In addition, I've been very involved as an education activist in the county of Rockland in particular, in the school district where I grew up, which is the East Ramapo Central School District, and have been active in the space of criminal justice reform as part of a local organization here.
Well, Mondaire, we got to take a break so that I can try and question what I've been doing with my life after hearing what you've been able to accomplish in such a short period of time. When we come back, I want to get a little bit more deeply into which issues you would prioritize and where you think right now what the Democrats should be doing in the House as we are a year away, a little bit more, from the 2020 election. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back after this. So, Mondaire, you basically walked us through your experience, which, frankly, it took me some time to digest. Incredibly impressive record of activism and education and practice, and simultaneously dealing with the issues that I think are probably at the forefront of at least. Somewhat in terms of your campaign. You talk about student debt, and you talk about education reform that you've been involved in, working for vetting federal judges during the Obama administration. So give me a sense of, and we should remind people you're challenging a 30-year veteran who's been in the House in New York 17th District, and frankly, it seems like, you know, across the board, and I mean this no disrespect to folks of my age or older, but your generation, what it means to be a progressive today, what it means to come from a deep blue district in a deep blue state, is fundamentally different than what it was 30 years ago. For better or for worse, that is the case, and there is an expectations. If you're not moving forward, then you're going backwards, it seems to me. What would you look for as an incoming freshman? Like, give me your sense of how you see you would fit into a Congress. I mean, one of the things that we've seen with incoming freshmen in the last 2018 election was there have been more, it seems to me, aggressiveness and caucusing by freshmen than we've seen in the past.
It is critical and certainly possible for freshmen such as what I hope to be in Congress to be the lead on so many of these issues. Student debt forgiveness, for example, is a top priority for me. So is the Green New Deal. We are faced with the existential crisis known as climate change, and the idea that everyone in Congress, certainly every Democrat, has not signed on to support that legislation by now is unconscionable to me. We have to make radical action by over the next 12 to 15 years, and if not, it's going to be too late. I mean, we've already seen so much of our infrastructure degraded. And the things that we're talking about as part of the Green New Deal, a guaranteed green jobs program with training, trillions of dollars in training for folks who are going to be as part of a transition from a carbon economy to a post-carbon economy, sort of displaced, these are things that we should be embracing. We should be embracing the idea that everybody would have a job that pays a living wage under a Green New Deal. We should embrace the idea that we are going to shore up our infrastructure to withstand dramatic weather conditions. And these are things that I care about because my generation, including myself, is in the process of inheriting a planet that's devastated by climate change.
So the Green New Deal, obviously a massive priority because of it, the existential threat to the country. I mean, talk to me about your feelings about Medicare for All, where we've heard a lot of different variations of Medicare for All plan. Give me a sense of what you think is the best case scenario from a policy standpoint, and give me a sense of what you think the politics are behind this.
You know, I've had so many conversations about this with people in my district, including folks of my grandmother's generation. And people are concerned. People are concerned about what it means to lose your private insurance. Here's what I support. I support a system where folks get more coverage than what they currently get, where the out-of-pocket costs of people who are part of this Medicare for All system are not going to increase, but rather will actually decrease, and a system where people will still get to keep their physicians and to go to any hospital or medical provider, you know, medical provider that they choose to go to. And those are my prerequisites for any program that I would vote for. And that is shaping up to be a Medicare for All system, otherwise known as, you know, I think we can call it universal health care. But these are things that people are concerned about, and I think they're going to be satisfied with the care that they receive under a Medicare for All system. And our challenge as Democrats is cutting through the noise, not adopting Republican talking points about how the elimination of private insurance is going to spell the end of the world, which is simply not true. And I think does a great disservice. I was watching the debates recently, like many other folks, and I was so disappointed in some of the comments that were made by people who should know better, I think.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think the folks, to the extent that people are worried about losing their private insurance, it's because they want to make sure that it's just they can go see their doctor. I don't think anybody is going to miss dealing with the copays, dealing with the filing stuff. But, you know, people are afraid of going from the frying pan into the fire. And I think there needs to be a lot of education about what their options are. Give me a sense of what else. I mean, so Green New Deal, single-payer health care, or at least what you call universal health care. Where are you on student debt? I mean, not asking personally. You've hopefully you've worked that off through a legal career. But what is your perspective on free college, debt-free college? Where do you land on that spectrum?
I am a huge supporter of the elimination of the $1.6 trillion in student debt that young people and folks of an older generation are still shouldering. You know, the average debt load for someone leaving college, as of 2016 at least, was $37,000. It was more like $10,000 in the early 90s. And so my generation was sold this bill of goods that if we just went to college and worked hard, everything would just work out. And that's just not true. That's not true. And now we as a society owe it to folks with student debt to eliminate that and to allow them to be participating members of this economy. Imagine having $37,000 and then taking a job that pays you $40,000. I mean, what do you do in that situation? Well, you have to ask your parents, if you have them, to crash at their place. And then how do you build a family? It's not good for our economy. It's not good for civil society. And we need to address it with bold action. I think a student debt forgiveness program has to be paired with free tuition at public colleges and universities. And in addition to an investment in our trade schools and in HBCUs or historically black colleges and universities.
Mondaire Jones, tell us, where can people get more information about your candidacy?
You can go to MondaireForCongress.com, M-O-N-D-A-I-R-E, ForCongress.com. And feel free to make a donation. I'm not taking corporate PAC money, unlike my opponent. And I need all the resources I can get to put together the strongest possible challenge. And I've got to say, I've been so encouraged to hear from folks at the grassroots level on up who are acknowledging that it is time for a change, that we have not been served well, especially in recent years. And you can have great respect for someone like I do and still come to the conclusion that it's time to shake things up a bit.
Mondaire Jones, thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Mondaire Jones's campaign at MondaireForCongress.com. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. A special thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers who converted into members this week to help support the show. We cannot thank you enough. We need you desperately to continue to put this show out. If you're listening to the free one-hour podcast, consider becoming a member of the full show over at ROFpodcast.com. We've actually opened it up during this whole COVID-19 thing, so you'll be getting the full show. But head over, become a member so that you support our work. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day and doing in-depth interviews almost every day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.